The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Welcome to 9/11 Freefall. I'm the host, Andy Steele. Well, this week it's my honor to have on J. Michael Springman. He's the former head of the American Visa Bureau in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. He's spoken extensively about his experiences in that role and its relation to 9/11, which you'll be talking about today. He's also an author, and we'll be learning more about his books at the end of this program. Mr. Springman, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Well, thank you kindly. I appreciate the honor of being able to speak to your listeners and to maybe fill in some of the blanks in their knowledge or to go over the stuff that they may have forgotten.
Absolutely. I actually remember sitting in the audience at conferences, 9/11 Truth conferences, in the early development of this movement and seeing you. And it's so surreal now that we're here talking over the internet and having you here on my show. So let's get started, and please begin, because there's a lot of new people in the movement who weren't following back in 08 and 10 when you were giving these presentations a lot. Begin by telling us about your career leading up to your time in Saudi Arabia.
Sure. In the past, I had worked for the Commerce Department and participated in the State Commerce Exchange Program, and that was essentially the Commerce Department making slots available in Washington for Foreign Service officers who needed a D.C. assignment, but there was no room at State. And in return, State would give Foreign Service positions to Commerce Department employees abroad. And I had been in Stuttgart. I had been in India as part of the new Foreign Commercial Service. And when I joined the real estate department, as a reward, they sent me to Saudi Arabia. And I got to tell you, when I was in Saudi Arabia, it was a really strange and mysterious place. But I don't think it's quite as strange and mysterious as the American Consulate General on Palestine Road. There, I found out that they had some real strange problems with visas. Before I left Washington, the American ambassador, Walter Cutler, had been in town for consultations with State Department officials and other government officials for a couple of weeks. And I had been asked by an official at the State Department working with Saudi Arabia if I wanted to meet the ambassador. And I said, oh, of course. And I figured this would be a hello and goodbye session. Thanks, I'm joining your new official family in a few weeks and so forth. Well, Cutler had me there for 45 minutes talking about all the problems my terrible predecessor had created for him and the embassy in Riyadh. So I thought, well, this woman, Greta Holtz, is going to make my career for me. But I began to hear strange things in Washington about visas, and I had been told by a long-term consular officer that if you hear strange things about visas, you should investigate because they can come back and bite you and damage your career. So I kept asking, well, what is it that you heard and what is it that I'm going to be walking into? And never got any answer back. I tried the executive office for the Bureau of Near East South Asia and got nowhere. So I had tried, in fact, to find out information from my predecessor, Greta Holtz, about, well, what did you wish you had known before you got to Jeddah? What surprises did you find that I should know about? And I wrote three times, never got an answer back. So I turned up in Jeddah, and it turned out that I was in at the beginning of the American government's program for visas for terrorists, recruiting and training terrorists to go around the world and overthrow governments and assassinate people. But I didn't know it at the time. I was there at the visa window interviewing applicants, and I would refuse a lot of them. They are supposed to demonstrate ties either to their own country or to their place of application that are strong enough to force them to return from a visit to the United States. It's things like having a job that you can't give up, or you have investments that you have to manage, or you have family there and you can't leave your wife and children for the rest of your life, and so forth. You know, every person is different, but by and large, these are some of the things that you need to demonstrate to show that you have ties that are going to compel you to return from a brief visit to America. And I'd refuse them, and I would get a call from the consul general. And you need to give this guy a visa. And I said, well, he doesn't meet the Immigration and Nationality Act requirements, and he doesn't meet the State Department's own criteria set out in the Foreign Affairs Manual, which is the State Department's Bible on how to do everything. And at first it was a request, then it was a strong request, then it was a demand, and then it was a threat. If you don't issue the visa, you're going to be unemployed. So this went on for a while, during the 18 months I was there in Jeddah. And I began to hear things that were circulating, like people expected that if I didn't issue the visa, Fares would overrule me, which of course was illegal and against State Department regulations. You have to produce evidence that the individual in question, he's been given more information to the overruling officer than the interviewing officer. And of course, Jay Frères wasn't a consular officer. He was consul general. He was in charge of the whole consulate there. So you needed somebody like the head of the consular section. And, you know, that didn't happen very much. So I began keeping notes on this, making photocopies of the application form with my notes on it as to why I'd refused the guy, and with the notation that I'd been ordered by J. Philip Frères to issue the visa. And I was astonished at this, and I began getting really wretched efficiency reports. In fact, I'd been told by a contact outside the consulate, who was a businessman, that if you say one word about the visas or about the problems with alcohol at the consulate to this inspection team that's coming out, you're going to be unemployed. And periodically, the State Department sends a team of inspectors out to embassies and consulates around the world to ensure that they're running smoothly, that they're following the regulations, that they haven't broken any laws, et cetera. Well, when the guy came out and interviewed me, I kept saying, I'm sorry, I can't tell you anything. And he kept pushing me and pushing me and pushing me, saying that if you don't do this, you know, we can't write a decent efficiency report. And this is like the confessional or the attorney-client privilege. What you tell me is absolutely secret. So finally, after about an hour, he wore me down, and I simply confirmed what he had told me about alcohol being sold to people who are not qualified for it, people outside the consulate, and problems with people inside the consulate getting alcohol. And the whole issue of the visas and how strange it was and why I was being overruled. And after that, he simply gave his report to the consul general, who wrote me a ferociously bad efficiency report. Now, this went on in large part because most of the consulate worked for the Central Intelligence Agency or the National Security Agency or another intelligence service. And there were, in fact, out of some 20 Americans there, there were only three people, including myself, whom I knew for a certainty to be State Department employees. Might have been a couple more, but by and large, it was simply an intelligence operation. And they really, really pushed this. They would give parties and get people liquored up with free alcohol or nearly free alcohol where it was forbidden in Jeddah and listen to what they were saying. And of course, they also listened to what people were saying about them. In one instance, one woman I had heard had mentioned at one of these pool parties where the alcohol was flowing freely that so-and-so had been a member of the Central Intelligence Agency, and she was promptly fired. But it was a very questionable operation, When I questioned, for example, my predecessor, whom I met on a visit to Jeddah, she come up from Yemen, from Sana'a, and I said, well, why didn't you answer my three letters? Oh, well, I was so upset that I think that I really couldn't have written you anything back. Well, it turned out once I looked at her biography, once I was out of the State Department, I found out that she'd worked for the intelligence services. She'd worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency before she joined the State Department. And she apparently created such problems, I was told, that Jay Ferris called down to the embassy in Sana'a and said, oh, she should be taken out of the Foreign Service. Well, I think a lot of this was simply talk. I think it was a cover. I think it was an operation to convince me that I should get with the program, only they never bothered to tell me what the program was. Because Greta Holtz, the great troublemaker, went on to a good high-level position in Iraq. And later on, she was named the American ambassador to Oman by Barack Obama. So I think that I was being given a fairy tale because I was the one who complained and I was the one who was fired. Yet she supposedly had made a mess of things in Jeddah and in Sana'a, and yet she got promoted to ambassador. So that shows you how the place works and how the State Department works. But unfortunately, as I learned once I'd been thrown out of the State Department, without actually being told why, I in fact had filed a Freedom of Information Act about this and had sought to find out why I had been fired. Well, I got the Foreign Freedom of Information Act quashed and dismissed as a threat to national security. And I still wonder to this day how finding out why I was fired makes me a threat to national security. So as time went by, once I was out of the State Department and had still kept an eye on the CIA and the State Department and what was really happening, I filed another Freedom of Information Act asking for what I should have asked the first time, copies of all of the documents that I had denied all of these visa applications. And as a result, I got nowhere with the State Department. So I filed another Freedom of Information Act lawsuit on my own. And the State Department said, oh, dismiss the case. There aren't any documents there. We dismiss them every year. We shred them. We get rid of them. They aren't gone. They have been gone for many, many years. Well, that was unfortunately not true because I said in an affidavit to the court that the situation was that when I was there, we had five drawer filing cabinets in the file room and in the consular section offices filled to overflowing with old visa applications that went back 10, 15 years. And I talked to my staff and I said, but look, you know, we've got to start shredding some of this stuff. We have no room to put away the new visa applications. And we're supposed to shred these things after a certain amount of time. And they said, Mike, what do you want us to do? Do you want us to shred the visa applications or do you want us to deal with the 200 visa applications a day that we're getting sometimes at high season and process the paperwork and make sure they get their passports back with the visas in them the same day? And I said, yeah, forget the shredding. Continue on with the paperwork for the visas and the passports. But the strangest thing was, of course, at the time, I'd been pulled aside by Eric Quackenbush, the CIA base chief there, and he said, we got this guy coming in. He's an Iranian. His family has an Oriental rug store in Jeddah, and we want to talk to him in Washington for consultations. And he's been to the States before, so, you know, make it look good, wink, wink. Well, the guy came in, and he had a perfect application. He had been to the States before. There were previous American visas in the passport. He had a letter explaining what he was doing in the U.S., and when he answered my usual questions about, well, you know, who do you work for, how long are you going to be gone, what kind of ties do you have that's going to hold you here in Saudi Arabia, he answered them all, and I said, please, God, give me some more visa applicants like him. So I really wonder how many other applications I got that were clean and had no questions that were really CIA operatives that were being sent to Washington for training or instruction or consultations or whatever. And I still wonder to this day why Eric Quackenbush didn't clue me in on what they were doing at the consulate. with all these strange visa applications that should have been dismissed by any knowledgeable consular officer. So once I was out of state, I wrote a book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts That Rocked the World. And I went back and looked at the visas and looked at this what I call the Arab-Afghan Legion. It was essentially the same people they recruited for the Mujahideen to fight in Afghanistan against the then Soviet Union. And these were people recruited, trained, and supported by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, and by Pakistan's inter-services intelligence. And I decided from what I had seen in Yugoslavia and in Libya and in Syria and in Iraq that this is a pattern here. We don't have an organization that's maybe as well organized as the United States Marine Corps, but we do have a group of people who were trained by the United States in terrorist activities, trained, in fact, in the United States, mostly in military facilities on the East Coast. There were 52 recruiting offices in the United States alone, including one in Washington, D.C. Now, I've never been able to track down where these offices were. That's the one thing I miss doing. From my research, I found out that these people were doing a very good job of what we trained them for, essentially shooting things down and blowing things up. And at the National Press Club here in Washington, they had a couple of people come in the McClendon Study Group, a organization founded by the late journalist Sarah McClendon, and then continued by one of her contacts, John Edward Hurley. And they would have unusual people with strong stories to tell that weren't covered by the mainstream media. And two of the people they had were Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer and former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel of the Democratic Party. And I asked Schaefer, you know, you've written this book, Dark Heart, you were in Afghanistan and other places. Are the people that were still fighting there the same people that we recruited for Afghanistan? And he said, yeah, maybe if not the same people, it may be people that they trained themselves, but by and large, we're fighting the same people we came up with fighting in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union, and they've been sort of moved and rebranded to other parts of the world. And when Mike Gravel was there, he was the guy who published the Pentagon Papers on the floor of the United States Senate and inserted them into the congressional record and had been sued by the United States government repeatedly. And finally, the Supreme Court said the Constitution reads very clearly that a serving member of Congress can say anything he wants on the floor of the House or the Senate, as long as it's not treason or something like this. So Gravel, again, in my response to my questions about this, said, yes, indeed, we're fighting the same people we had trained to fight the Soviet Union years ago. So throughout my book, I go into great detail about this. I name names. I talk about what's happening. I go back, in fact, to the very beginning, to the late 1940s, where we had the creation of the national security state. Harry Truman, president at the time, had misgivings about legislation for the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency in 1948. He had, in fact, been warned by Secretary of State George Marshall, who had been a Army general prior to that, all throughout the war, as chief of staff. And he had said to the president that this is dangerous. It undercuts the authority of the president and of the Congress. And Truman himself later on said, we were concerned that this might turn into an American Gestapo. And he was right. These people control the government. The government doesn't control them. They control the American news media. They came up years ago in the 1950s with a program called Operation Mockingbird, which started with the Washington Post. Philip Graham, who had been editor and publisher and married to Catherine Graham, who succeeded him, he was the guy who said, yes, sure, I'll agree with the CIA. I'll plant stories on behalf of the agency. I'll let CIA officials take positions as reporters in my newspaper. I'll let them write stories. I will publish their stories and so on and so forth. And this went on not with the Washington Post, but with the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, all of the major news media, which is essentially owned by maybe five or six corporations. So I think that this grew and grew and grew until we came up with the Mujahideen war against the Soviet Union and the creation of the Arab Afghan Legion, the graduates of the program, which were spread out and trained and used throughout the Middle East and elsewhere, and who knows where else they'll be used next. So by and large, that's a summary of my book, and I'm willing to happily entertain any questions you might have.
It's fascinating how many people get punished for actually doing their job as it's stated to them when they first enter service into this government. Now, in one of your talks, I was actually there when you gave this, and I've rewatched it on the last day, but you spoke once of Pakistanis getting issued visas to visit a trade show in the U.S. when they couldn't even name this show. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. That was a situation where these two guys came in. They've been sent over, they said, by the commercial section, and they were going on a trade mission to the United States. The Commerce Department sponsors these things and tries to bring businessmen from abroad on a particular subject like computers or auto parts and accessories or other industrial subjects, you name it. They'll have a trade mission on it. And these guys came in and said they were going to the APA show. And I said, what's the APA show? Well, we don't know. It's just APA. And it was really the auto parts and accessories show. And it's held every year in Chicago. And I said, well, where's the big deal? Oh, in Detroit. And I said, no, you're not getting a visa. And then Paul Arvid Tveit, T-V-E-I-T, the CIA clandestine service officer hidden in the commercial section, called me up within the hour and said he wanted these guys to get visas. And I said, no, they didn't establish real ties to Saudi Arabia or to Pakistan. And more importantly, they had no idea of what show they were going to or where it was located. So I think this whole thing is very suspicious. And they had ample opportunity to explain themselves in response to my questions. So no. So then he calls the head of the consular section, Justice, which was his given name, Stevens, and got the visas issued in just a few minutes. So that was typical of this. I mean, these were not the only guys I had problems with, but this is very typical of the situation. And if you want to get into the 9/11 part of things, my successor several times removed, Shana Steinger, S-T-E-I-N-G-E-R, she was in Jeddah issuing visas to most of the so-called hijackers that got their visas in Saudi Arabia. I think something like the numbers keep changing depending on who you talk to. But by and large, some 15 Saudis got visas in Jeddah and they went off and hijacked airliners in the United States. In Saudi Arabia. 11 of the 15 got them in Jeddah and they got them from Shana Steinger. I called her in response to a journalist, Nicholas Velassi, who had found her out in Iowa after she left the State Department, supposedly. And she told me, oh, all I did was what I was told to do. I didn't do anything wrong, et cetera, et cetera, and actually said nothing. So I asked her, you know, repeatedly what happened and never got an answer back. And I had seen some things in the efficiency report on Jeddah about her saying that she gave equivocal answers to some of the inspection team's questions about the issuing these visas to the supposed hijackers. According to Balassi, and as I checked following his words, Shana Steinger has a thing on LinkedIn that says she's back in the State Department. Yet when I called her at her new address in Reston, Virginia, she never answered the phone. I have been tied up with some clients, so I haven't written her a letter, I guess, making sure that she gets something in writing from me asking about, well, what's changed? Why are you back in state? Because when state hired her, they hired her at the equivalent of a GS-13, an FSO-4, and they hired her right out of Columbia University with a master's degree. And state doesn't hire people, new hires, at that level. I got in as an FSO-5, because I had been the equivalent in the Commerce Department for a good number of years. But in her case, she had no real experience, but except the degree, supposedly. So So, you know, she's another question that I'd like to follow up on and may never get an answer, no matter how hard I try.
You have tried to reach out to members of Congress about this, you said, in another presentation. How did that go for you?
It went nowhere. I went to the what was then the General Accounting Office, which was the government's watchdog on the executive branch, and they wouldn't talk to me. I tried the Inspector General at the State Department and got nowhere. I talked to a member of the staff of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and his response was, "Don't you think we need the CIA?" Well, I don't know what I told him at the time, but I can tell you now that we do not need the CIA. It's a clear and present danger to the country. Then I wrote letters to various congressmen. I wrote to Nancy Pelosi, of course, and again got no response. It was absolute dead silence. So the agency is basically backed by Congress. They know or don't want to know, depending on how you want to look at it. And they're quite happy and comfortable with the current situation. I mean, as I note at the beginning of my book, I quote Thomas Jefferson. I say that it is error alone which needs the support of government. Truth can stand by itself. Well, the trick is, how are we going to get at the truth? Because the government has surrounded it with a bodyguard of lies, and that far too many people believe what the government tells them because it's the government. They know they've been elected. They have backgrounds. They have been serving officers in the armed forces. They've been former ambassadors. They've been this and they've been that. They've been congressmen with access to classified information. And the only classified information I've ever seen is basically stuff that can be printed on the front page of the Washington Post. It maybe if you took a couple of names out. But by and large, you know, it's too much we believe and we trust in our government.
We're only in a few minutes here. I want to make sure that people can follow up with you because this is certainly interesting. You've got another book out as well. Talk about that, please. And also, how can people follow your work or get a hold of your books?
Okay. Well, they can get a hold of the books through Amazon. Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA Handouts that Rock the World is available in English and in German as The CIA und der Terror. The other book, Goodbye Europe? Hello Chaos? Merkel's Migrant Bomb, talks about it was essentially a follow-up to Visas for Al-Qaeda, about what happened after the United States dehoused, deculturalized, and destroyed the nations of the Middle East and North Africa. They drove the people out because they had no jobs, they had no employment, they had no factories, they had no water processing plants, and herded them into Europe to destabilize Europe, to create an Americanized Europe rather than, de Gaulle's view, a Europeanized Europe. The American government was deathly afraid of Germany's intelligence and education and expertise linking up with Russia and natural resources in Russia, as well as the educated Russian people and their industry as well. And you've seen that trying to split the undersea pipeline, the Nord Stream 2, going from Russia to Germany. So the whole point is that these migrants were invited in, one partly because the Americans were pushing them in, partly because they saw the migrants as a source of cheap labor, just as they do here in the United States, and a source of votes for the party that brings them in and makes a successful transition to putting them there. However, I go through this and I tie the migrants repeatedly to the intelligence services and the questionable activities thereof. One of these people who had murdered a number of people in Germany and Berlin at the Christmas market. He traveled all through Germany, through France, and got into Italy before he was found. And the Germans have a very good intelligence service at home, and they have a very good external intelligence services. I think the total is something like 8,000 members in both, and they couldn't find this guy. Additionally, I go into extensive detail on this. It's been translated into German as well. It's called Überrollt, essentially rolled over. And it's also in Spanish under the title Adios Europa, Bienvenido al Caos. And both of them are also available on Amazon. I've got, I'm up on Facebook and Twitter. Facebook is under my name, J. Michael Springman, and Twitter is, I think, at Mike Springman. I have a website, michaelspringman.com, that has a little bit of information on my two books and ways of getting in touch with me. So I welcome anybody looking at these books. I think that they will open their eyes. I've certainly had complaints with the editors when they were looking at the books because I had too many footnotes in the books. I think that they're about 350 each. So the story is there, and it's backed up. It's not speculation.
J. Michael Springman, thank you so much for taking this half hour with us and your time and for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
Well, I greatly appreciate the opportunity, and I hope that your listeners enjoyed it as much as I did.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. Andy Steele. Say have a great week. Good luck.